Evolution today as Mark Knoll's 11th turning point. Last week, I was trying to draw some connections between John Wesley and Pietism on the continent and then American evangelicalism that we see today. And there's a lot more to say about that. But because we're tracing that history well into the 19th century at least, we're going to start with the French Revolution, and then we'll go back to finish up what we were talking about last week. So Wesley comes before the French Revolution, but a lot of the effects that we're going to talk about in American evangelicalism are post-French Revolution, which, of course, is about the same time period as the American Revolution. So a little review of French revolutionary history. So the last decade of the 18th century is when most of these events are happening. It's in 1789 that the National Assembly is formed. You have a council in operation in France that takes on full power, and the king is deposed at first kind of on house arrest, and then eventually in January of 1793, he's executed along with the Queen Marie Antoinette. Very familiar events. That's the point at which the Jacobins take control, Robespierre, the use of the guillotine, and the consequent reign of terror. After that, you have the a couple other developments. You've got the Directory. Robespierre himself is guillotined. And then you have the first council period and the first consul. In 1804 is, of course, Napoleon, and then you have the Napoleonic era up through 1815 when he finally meets his Waterloo. And so you have a revolution that casts off monarchical power, and it's replaced with a different kind of tyranny, which in some ways is worse. So you have monarchy giving way to totalitarianism in very short period of time, a fascinating story. One of the fascinating elements of the story is the relationship between American revolutionary thinkers, founding fathers, and French revolutionaries early on. So there was a lot of support in America for French revolutionary ideas. There was a lot of optimism, thinking that, well, the liberty that we are talking about, these inalienable rights that we're talking about, are having such an influence that we have this ancient monarchy, this very powerful monarchy in France, being upset as well. And then heads started rolling, and most Americans were much more measured and reserved in their response to that as, whoa, what's going on? We didn't mean kill everyone, right? And of course, the French Revolution is not a result of the American Revolution, but there's influences on each other. So Knoll highlights this event in terms of the relationship between the French Revolution and Christianity, because besides, you know, essentially state-sponsored terrorism, you also have an official atheism that is really a precursor to what is to come, especially in the 20th century. But on the top of your sheet, you can see in 1793, French revolutionaries renamed the Cathedral of Notre Dame the Temple of Reason, enacting their enlightened views through a demonstration of liberty played by a famous French opera singer, bowing to the flame of reason. This event was, quote, a high point in the French Revolution's program of de-Christianization. And this is a program of de-Christianization. This is what can we do to eliminate Christianity and its influences from our society. Right? So that there are many priests sent into exile, many beaten, many executed, and basically the power of the Roman Catholic Church, which was very, very strong in France at the time, is being stripped away. And so Knoll says on page 251, the turning point in the history of Christianity represented by the de-Christianizing effort of the French Revolution was the end, or at least the beginning of the end, of European Christendom as the dominant expression of Christianity in the world. So remember, he highlighted the establishment of Christendom with Charlemagne in the Holy Roman Empire, and this is its end. And so we have the beginning now of what we might call a secular age, where Enlightenment ideas are influencing Europe. And there will never be this connection between the church and the state that there previously was. There will never be, at least up to this point, the same kind of regard for the church and her interests. So during that period of Christendom, our concerns were about corruption, purity in the church, battles within the church. We talked about the Avignon papacy, those kinds of issues. And now we have a new kind of battle between state power and the church itself. As I mentioned several weeks ago, I don't believe that there is a particular relationship between church and state that is necessarily best for the church. I think you've seen the church flourish in a number of different environments, and you've seen the church weak in a number of different environments as well. So the point is not that the end of Christendom means like somehow the gospel is not going to be as effective. But in terms of the way we think about the church, it's a different thing after the French Revolution. There's a different thing once we can't really talk about Christendom anymore. And one of the issues that'll come up today is, has that flame of a sort of Christian state or Christian influences strongly in the political realm, is that flame carried to the New World and the American colonies? To what extent? Is there any sense in which the American colonies carry on Christendom in the New World, even as Europe becomes post-Christian? So we'll talk about that a little bit today. Noel defines Christendom because it's not just those countries that would primarily identify with Christianity as opposed to Islam or Buddhism. He defines Christendom as, quote, that lengthy period of European history when the interests of church and society were thought to be the same and where it was almost universally assumed that Christian spiritual realities were more fundamental than realities of the temporal world. Okay, so broad generalization, we're talking about a 1,000-year period, but this is a decisive point of change. So some other observers on the French Revolution, as quoted by Noel, Edmund Burke, a guy that I admire, who wrote Reflections on the Revolution in France and also was very measured and balanced in his discussion of how Parliament ought to treat, so he's an Irishman, Parliament ought to treat the American colonies in the 1760s and beyond. But this is what he said in Reflections on the Revolution in France. This is written in 1790, right after the National Assembly and before the Terror and all of these people are killed. And he says, quote, "But what is liberty without wisdom and without virtue? It is the greatest of all possible evils, for it is folly, vice, and madness without tuition or restraint." So tuition here is tutelage or teaching. We pay tuition, meaning we're paying for being instructed. So tuition here, he means instruction. And so everybody recognizes that this is prescient, right? That he's saying something that certainly turns out to be true. We see the atheistic state being the most destructive, the very worst force of power we've seen in the world. Alexis de Tocqueville, famously visitor of America and very thoughtful, oft-quoted commentator on American life, who's a Frenchman, and he writes at the end of his life in 1856. So he was not alive during the French Revolution, but he was born in 1805, something like that. In France, Christianity was attacked with almost frenzied violence. There was no question of replacing it with another religion. Passionate and persistent efforts were made to wean men away from the faith of their fathers, but once they lost it, nothing was supplied to fill the void within. There is no question that the nationwide discredit of all forms of religious belief which prevailed at the end of the 18th century had a preponderant influence on the course of the French Revolution. This was, in fact, its most salient characteristic, and nothing did more to shock contemporary observers. So for all the tumult, what people commented on the most that was scariest was the treatment of priests, right? the irreligious nature of it. They had seen violence before, particularly in France. Bartholomew's Day massacre we didn't talk about, but there was a huge massacre of Calvinists in France. And so the Roman Church was itself certainly not friendly to other religious expressions during the time. But the irreligion was the noteworthy characteristic. Owen Chadwick's recent comment in 1975, I think, is really helpful when he says, the problem of secularization is not the same as the problem of enlightenment. Enlightenment was of the few. Secularization is of the many. Right? So this is another way of saying you have philosophers talking about big ideas, and a sea change in philosophy may not be officially adopted by the people, and they may not even read these philosophers like Voltaire or Rousseau, but their ideas influence the culture. And so while people wouldn't necessarily talk about reason the way these philosophers did, they wouldn't argue necessarily that man is autonomous, he is a law unto himself. They wouldn't promote humanism necessarily directly, but that's the way they begin to live. They begin to think in a secular manner, that there is life and then there is religious life. And there's this division between the sacred and the secular, even as there's a division between the church and the state as well. And then most recently, Arnold Toynbee said, quote, in the revolution, a sinister ancient religion, which had been dormant, suddenly re-erupted with elemental violence. This revenant was the fanatical worship of collective human power. The terror was only the first of the mass crimes that have been committed since the revolution in this evil religion's name. And I think we could see that so clearly in the French Revolution because of the pace of it. Right? So Robespierre killing everybody and then himself being killed. What's the difference in terms of the ideology of the Girondins and the Jacobins? It's very subtle. It's hard for an outside observer to really understand. It seems like they're all crazy, right? Why does the guy who's the leader become public enemy number one? Because there's a shift in power. It's the raw exercise of power. And we see that certainly with fascism and communism in the 20th century. So most of Knowles' chapter traces responses by three groups within Christianity, liberals, sectarians, and traditionalists, to Europe's weakening Christian influences. But he concludes with this insightful summary, which connects French revolutionary ideals to World War I. So I didn't think most of this chapter was very interesting as he traced these roots, even though I'm really interested in intellectual history. That's why I'm going to spend more time talking about what I started next week. But I do want to include this summary paragraph, which I think is really helpful. He says, nothing in Christendom's long, admittedly fallible history could match the depths of degradation to which the 19th century's new deities now led. From 1914 to 1918, supreme allegiance to nation, implicit reliance upon technology, which produced the marvels of poison gas, machine gun, tank, and bomber, and the triumphs of propaganda, erected with the marvels of mass communication, all joined forces to slaughter a full generation of European young people and lay waste the continent as it had not been decimated since the 14th century and the scourge of the Black Death. Only this time the survivors did not tremble, as many of them had in the 14th century, for fear of their sins before God, because they were secular, right? I've never read a historical commentary on the First World War that said it accomplished anything, right? Whatever the perspectives are, it's pretty much universally acknowledged that it was a total waste of life, right? And so what would produce that? What would produce devastation at that level for no clear purpose, that in a way in which no one really gains? In fact, we might say that Europe is simply prepared for another devastating war. So comments or questions on the French Revolution before we get back into American evangelicals? Okay, so I heard two different questions. Was there a turning point prior to 1789 in France? Like, are you talking about some sign that it was going to come? Or? Yeah, I think that while there are similarities between the American Revolution, the American experience, and the French Revolution, one of the significant differences is the population is much more religious in France, okay? Much more, you know, the power of the Roman Catholic Church is much greater than any form of Protestantism is in the American colonies at the time. But the biggest thing is probably the strength of the monarchy, right? So the difference between the haves and the have-nots, as we know in France in the 18th century, was much more extreme than in England and in English colonies. So the reaction was also much more violent. So I don't think that the revolution, from a popular perspective, was motivated by Enlightenment ideals. Okay? So the people that are exercising power are definitely motivated by Enlightenment ideals. But the people themselves just have something to gain in terms of new freedoms, right? And so there's a manipulation of the masses here who don't buy into the Enlightenment values of Voltaire and Rousseau and Robespierre and Danton and these guys, but they very much want to improve their lives. And once they're able to sort of villainize the king, then they start heading down that road, and then they kind of inherit the ideas. That's a lot different than America because of the foundation for government that we have. We already are coming from a tradition with a very strong parliament and an idea that the English king is under the law rather than being above the law. There's already been an executed king in England, right? And there's been a glorious revolution that's nothing like the bloody French Revolution. And so you have the rule of law in place in Britain and in the American colonies in a way that you don't in France. So that makes, you know, that I think is a big difference. Now, in terms of whether our current climate is bringing us towards something like World War III, I don't think we have a big change in ideas like we did at the time of the Enlightenment happening right now, unless you want to talk about the modern to postmodern shift, which is a couple of generations old now. So if we're talking about the consequences of postmodernism and what that's going to mean for international conflict, I think it'd be hard to summarize that until after our lifetimes to see exactly how those things play out. But we certainly don't have a worldview base that's going to promote peace today, right? Which they were losing there as well. So there's a parallel. But I'm saying a lot in answer to your question, but there's a lot of speculation necessary to answer. Yep. Influencing people according to ideas that they might not read about or adopt themselves. I would say absolutely. It's a very effective means of propaganda. Propaganda is most effective in those who are unfamiliar with history and don't read. They don't recognize what's being said, right? And so what do we know about our culture? People, their memory of events extends to their memory of news programs that they've seen, probably, right? They definitely do not have a historical or intellectual context to identify what's happening. And it's actually fought against, right? So you try to have civil discourse with people that are woke, for example, or you want to talk about gender issues, for example, you're almost committing sin in that discourse by referring to historical trends or previous views. Like, how dare you make some sort of patriarchal footnote, right? And so they're just going to yell. And so that demonstrates, yeah, you haven't read anything, you haven't thought these things through. And doing so wouldn't alleviate the conflict because, you know, they still believe in the autonomy of man. You know, they're still humanistic. But they'd be maybe a little bit less crazy if they did read. So we'll come into that as we talk about American evangelicalism as well. Anything else on the French Revolution before we get back to America? So week 10 continued on the flip side of your sheet. We had talked about John Wesley. We talked about his preaching kind of out of bounds, his preaching on the streets without the stamp of approval of the established church. And one of the things that we see there is passion and energy and excitement over against a kind of stale establishment. And how does the establishment respond to that? Well, my basic view on that would be an unwillingness to address those concerns by established churches and established churchmen allowed for this extreme overreaction, right? So there's some value in what Wesley is doing in trying to bring a gospel focus to his preaching, in trying to stimulate some sort of social action, and the church just saying no to that and responding in that way. What they're actually called in America, they're actually called old school and new school Presbyterians. So when I say, you know, they're old school, that's their actual title that they received. Their resistance to that kind of change, I think, creates these choices, right? Rather than some sort of modification that would be appropriate. Okay, so what are the links between Wesley and European Pietism and American evangelicalism? That's probably what we're most interested in, is our own context and where it came from. So I'm saying it came from at least two places. It came from John Wesley in England, and it came from German Pietism, and it produced what we see here. So two uses of evangelical. We can use the word evangelical in a couple of different ways. And if we talk about evangelical in the sense of its root, euangelion in Greek is gospel, good news. So evangelical is a gospel-focused person. Wesley is certainly an evangelical in that he's preaching salvation by grace, right? So he's evangelical as opposed to being Catholic in particular. But then the other meaning of evangelical refers to particular characteristics. And if you're not familiar with this distinction and you're reading and you find out people like Lutherans, for example, Lutheran scholars who are writing, they're saying we need to fight evangelicalism, right, in our church. And you think, why would you, what do you mean fighting? Why would you fight against the gospel, right? You're Lutherans, right? They don't mean the gospel. They mean the characteristics that we're talking about today. So I refer to myself as an evangelical because most people understand the term in the first sense. That's the way it's more frequently used. But if we get into a little bit of a deeper discussion, I would say, well, no, there's some distance from evangelicalism that I want between myself and those ideas, right? Or say, I sometimes use the phrase, the broadly evangelical American church, by which we mean a wider net than we would be in, right? Elements that we would be critical of, I hope. Okay, so major characteristics of American evangelicalism. You'll see a lot of overlap with the Pietism that I described last week. So these are especially coming out of the First Great Awakening. So there's a focus on an intense emotional conversion experience. Okay. And so because of that focus, we have a different way of understanding what it means to be a Christian. We have to recognize that this movement of evangelicalism was mostly preaching to churched people, not all of them church members, but all of them living within this society that is explicitly promoting Christian ideas, right? So the idea that someone who has been raised in the church needs to have an experience of conversion means that we don't think that the nurture in the church that has been characteristic of the church through the age is sufficient, right? I had a personal experience with this because I went to a camp that was it was not officially Assembly of God, but most of the people were AG in the camp that I went to as a kid, and I ended up working there for several summers when I was in my college years as well. Wonderful experience. But when I was there as a kid, I was led to the Lord by praying a prayer and going through these steps. And I came home and I told my parents, and my dad got mad. I thought, why? I didn't understand why he was upset. And he said, well, son, you were already a Christian, right? And he was right, I was. But basically, my counselor convinced me that I wasn't so that he could lead me to the Lord, right? Because from his perspective, and he didn't know any better, he was a teenager, right? From his perspective, unless I had this experience and prayed to invite Jesus into my heart, I wasn't a Christian, right? And he wanted to make sure that he could say that I was, and then I had that experience. So now, later on, I can understand why that was upsetting to my dad. He thought that I was being manipulated in some way, or he was, you know, doubt was being created in my mind when I already believed all the things that I was saying I subscribed to, right? I had already been baptized, even. And I grew up in a Baptist church, so I was baptized when I was 9. I had made a public profession of faith. I was definitely a Christian. I knew that I was a Christian, but I became convinced that there was a step that I had not yet taken, right? And I think that that is a generally negative influence. We see that in American evangelicalism today when there's this emphasis on a testimony and emphasis on an experience. The more sordid your past was, the better your testimony is. So you hear people talking about, you know, I was a Hell's Angel and I killed 7 people and then I came to Jesus Christ and glory be because of what he's done in my life. You're like, oh, I grew up in the church and I said no to my mom once, but, right? I don't even have any tattoos, right? So we see that coming out of this period as well, and that's why you have these big tent revivals, revival meetings, and you have people from churches coming out to these places in order to have this intense emotional experience. It's sort of like camp, right? Sort of like camp for adults. And one of the things that we see, I didn't put it on the sheet here, but one of the things that we see is that the awakenings, both of them, especially the second great awakening, are really driven by the conversion of women. Because of the emotional emphasis, there comes to be this idea that women are naturally more religious than their husbands, and they need to go home and evangelize their husbands, right? This also comes out of the Industrial Revolution, where there's this separation where men previously often worked in the home with their wives, and home and work these boundaries were crossed. You had a shop in the front of your house. You lived in your house. You served people from your shop with a child on your hip, right? A very different mindset than the Industrial Revolution. Man goes off to work, and now we begin to define his role more in terms of just breadwinning. And mom's at home, and mom raises the children, and we sort of ignore the fact that Scripture says that raising the children is a responsibility that's given primarily to dad, right? He's the one who is accountable for the spiritual health of the family, even if mom spends more time with the kids. So we lose that a little bit. And then there's this idea that the workplace is a competitive, unedifying place, and that women who are more religious need to start, you know, preaching to their husbands. And we come to the idea that we joke about even today where, you know, dad is like one of the kids, right? And so you joke about how, oh, mom is going on a trip. Pray for me, right? Because I have to care for my children, right? And at some point it became humorous for a man to say that he was incompetent to raise his children or to care for them if his wife wasn't there. Right, so a lot of things changing during this period of time. But you can understand how an emotional influence would, you know, there's more women coming forward. There's certainly many men as well. But when you see the manifestations of these conversions, there's weeping, there's rolling around on the ground, and this becomes a marker that the Spirit really is at work. Okay? And the Spirit really was at work. We'll talk about two different attitudes toward revival through a first Great Awakening figure, Jonathan Edwards, whom I love, and a second Great Awakening figure, Charles Finney, whom I love less. Okay. So the second is a deep suspicion of theological learning. Well, who are these staunch, staid, inactive people? They're the ones who have learned the most, right? They're the ones who know the most. In fact, in colonial America, the educated people were the ministers, right? And so there was a great deal of respect. There was a great deal of social clout that belonged to these people because they were the only ones who were really educated. And you have some of that starting to change a little bit. But what has their theological learning produced? It seems like, in many contexts, their theological learning has produced in them a resistance to the movement of the Spirit. And, of course, to the extent that that's true, it's awful, right? But these things are not, they're not the neat categories that the revivalists often made them to be. I think the biggest thing, probably practically, is you have a willingness to go among the revivalist preachers. And you have a willingness to stay home and be comfortable among the old school folks. And so there's a very real and practical consequence of that. The people who are willing to do the mission work on the frontier are going to determine this, what the spiritual beliefs and practices of those people are, right? Do you see a relationship between your attitude toward revival and the growth of the particular denomination in question? If I can generalize, I would say there's a short-term parallel between adopting methods and the growth of the church. But there's a long-term parallel between theological faithfulness and the health and growth of the church. So you see these explosions of growth according to these methods, but you don't see, so Methodism in the 18th century grows faster than any other denomination. What do we see in Methodism today? Significant decline. Why? Well, because feeling a certain way is not a recipe for growth. You can't maintain it, right? And so when the theology is lost and the foundation is lost and the instruction is lost, you're going to have brief periods of excitement. And unless that excitement is replaced, and in Methodism today, I don't think we even have some of the focus on intense emotional experiences that we have in broad American evangelicalism as well. So, you know, I think a mega church model. Certainly, there are churches that are very large and grow and are strong that have a stable theological base, where there's real pastoring of the people happening. But the easiest way to have rapid growth is through promotion, programming, right? And that's what people are coming for, and they're going to get bored with it. And so when you look at a lot of really large churches in the United States today, they might have 5,000 people, but they're not the same 5,000 people. Right, there's a lot of movement in and out of those churches because what is attractive in terms of that outward focus, the programming, the excitement, the big events, it doesn't have the kind of staying power like deep reflection on the things of God would have. Does that answer your question? Sort of? Okay. I'll take sort of. Okay. So the third thing is a celebrity model of leadership. And this kind of, the corollary of the celebrity model of leadership is the fact that revivalist preachers are not pastors. So we recognize in the New Testament that there is a gift of evangelism, but how do we understand that within a broader understanding of what the church is, right? So if you're an evangelist and you travel from place to place and preach, you need to recognize that when you leave, people need pastoring, right? And you're not a pastor. You're not their pastor. You're a preacher. And the focus on the celebrity of the guy who's coming in, because so many people have been converted under his ministry, or because articles in the paper are being written about him, the excitement is about the guy. Here comes the guy. We have to go listen to the guy, who's a lot more dynamic and a lot more exciting than the other guy that you hear every week, right? And so we can see that continuing today, and we can see fake or weak pastors making their millions through our desire in our culture to idolize and make celebrities of certain Christian figures, right? I think there's an association there with branding, a desire to create satellites of your church, right, which is different than planting churches. When you plant a church, that church has a pastor, right, not just a big screen of you. And that celebrity model attracts people. People will go to church because they get to watch a video of the big name guy. And we see that even before the video screen back in the revivalist times. And then an individualistic view of the church. I talked about this a little bit last week as well. The idea of church being a voluntary association of like-minded people, which I think is a great definition for a social club and a terrible definition for the church. Right? We are not a voluntary association of like-minded people, right? We are people who have been bought with a price, who are members of one body. We belong to each other regardless of whether we want to belong to each other. And one of the things that Pastor Lloyd says is there are people here that we wouldn't be hanging out with if it were not for Christ. That's part of the beauty of the gospel, right? That I can look at a guy like Trent and say, you're my brother, right? That's the gospel at work. Okay. All right. He sits in the front. I pick on him. Okay. So a few quotes from Nancy Piercy that discuss these bullet points that I've given you. Instead of talking about a gradual growth in faith through participation in a church, evangelicals began to treat a one-time conversion event as the only sufficient basis for claiming to be a Christian. Next, an atomistic, voluntaristic ecclesiology was born that did not reflect biblical teaching so much as the political philosophy of the day. And the point that Piercy is drawing out in these two chapters in Total Truth, where she discusses these things, is that political liberty has a huge influence on the way people view the church in America. In fact, one of her chapters is entitled, When America Met Christianity, Guess Who Won? And that's her perspective on it, is that the political environment influenced the church more than the church, the political environment. And so people were talking about, she's got a bunch of quotes about people using the language of the Declaration of Independence about their churches, right? Like being set free from the influence of the church and their pastors, right? What a staggering idea. That they're not talking about corruption. They're talking about the fact that there is power and authority in the church is a problem because it has to have a democratic base, right? With few outright atheists to address in the First Great Awakening, the revivalists did not seek to convert people to Christianity so much as to what they called experimental religion, the idea that religious truth should not merely be believed, but also be experienced. So here we have some truth, right? There should be a demonstration of your belief in the way that you behave. When somebody comes along and shakes you and says, I'd like to see a little bit more passion, your response should not be, I do theology, not passion, right? But this is the way it plays out, is you have these groups that I think are rightfully concerned that what's going to happen? This is all going to go haywire if we have this power to the people mentality within the church. If we have people preaching who don't need any kind of credential or or ordination to do so. And that's what's happened. What has this attitude led to? Well, what we see in the early 19th century is this explosion of all of these weird groups, right? Millerites and Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. And what do they all have in common in terms of the historical period from which they come? Ecclesiastical freedom, right? And so now we have a guy who gets to decide what the truth is, and if he can convince people through his dynamic personality or whatever it is, then you have a new church formed by the ideas of a guy, right? What was emerging was a new theology of conversion, the older view that believers are nurtured within the corporate church as whole persons, including the mind, through study and catechesis, was giving way to a new view that individuals undergo a one-time emotional decision that takes place outside the church. What a strange thing to expect that conversion to Christianity would happen outside the church, right? Is not the church for this very thing, right? Is not the covenant that we would train our children as they get up and as they go out and as they sit down these things and pray that they would believe them in their own hearts. So after the American Revolution, during the Second Great Awakening, spiritual liberty was equated with political liberty. I said I was going to mention Finney and Edwards, and their comments on revival specifically, I think, helped to show the difference, because Edwards was very involved in the First Great Awakening. He didn't change his methods. He preached long, monotone sermons that he had written, both before, during, and after the First Great Awakening. But what he saw was the movement of the Spirit, such that there was conversion that was more frequent and more impassioned than he had previously seen, without doing anything different. And as it turns out, the numbers kind of balanced out. In the decade of the First Great Awakening, you had the same number of converts, basically, as you had in the decade before and after. You just had them all really quickly, right, through this time. And he refers to revival as a surprising work of God, right? And it's something that he welcomes and he celebrates, right? God is at work in our midst, and he is drawing people to himself. It's not something that Edwards tried to manufacture. And when it left, he didn't say, "What am I doing wrong now?" Because he believed that people are drawn to God by the power of the Holy Spirit, right? Charles Finney said that revival is the right use of the means that we've been given, and he specifically called it a work of man, right? You can make revival happen if you do things a certain way. And if you define revival in terms of an emotional response, all you need to do is manufacture a particular emotional environment, right? And guess what? It still works, right? Now the question is this true conversion? And I think to answer that question, sometimes it is, but to answer that question, you got to look a little bit down the road, right? Are these people that are being converted over and over again by Billy Graham, for example? Or do we see a life of faithfulness in the church, in the community, that come from it? All right, we'll have to end there.